welcome to the Delling Pod with me, James Dellingpole. And I know I always say I'm excited about this week's special guest, but before we meet him, let's have a word from one of our sponsors.
Global warming is a massive con. There was no evidence whatsoever that man-made climate change is a problem, that it's going to kill us, that we need to amend our lifestyle in order to deal with it. It's a non-existent problem. But how do you explain this stuff to your normie friends? Well, I've just brought out the revised edition of my 2012 classic book, Watermelons, which captures the story of how some really nasty people decided to invent the global warming scare in order to fleece you, to take away your freedoms, to take away your land. It's a shocking story. I wrote it, as I say, in 2011 actually, the first edition came out. And it's a snapshot of a particular era. The era when the people behind the climate change scam got caught red-handed, tinkering with the data, torturing till it screamed, in a scandal that I helped christen ClimateGate. So I give you the background to the skullduggery that went on in these seats of learning where these supposed experts were informing us, we've got to act now. I rumbled their scam. I then asked the question, okay, if it is a scam, who's doing this and why? It's a good story. I've kept the original book pretty much as is, but I've written two new chapters, one at the beginning and one at the end, explaining how it's even worse than we thought. I think it still stands up. I think it's a good read. Obviously I'm biased, but I'd recommend it. You can buy it from jamesdellingpole.co.uk/shop. You'll probably find that one. Just go to my website and look for it, jamesdellingpole.co.uk. And I hope it helps keep you informed and gives you the material you need to bring round all those people who are still persuaded that, oh, it's a disaster, we must amend our ways and appease the gods, appease Mother Gaia. No, we don't. It's a scam.
Welcome to the Delling Pod, Tony Gosling. I should have had you on ages ago because you have done some very interesting research into something that was part of my life for about 3 years in the days when I was really into my military history and when I was writing military history novels. And I wrote this book called Coward at the Bridge, which is a rip-roaring read. But it was...
Who was your coward?
He's called Dick Coward. He was a hero.
Okay.
I think you've done a Dennis
Wheatley and done a historical novel, because there most definitely were one or two serious cowards at the bridge. Maybe you sensed there was, you know, that was the story to tell about it.
It was more that I had this character called Dick Coward, and his name was Coward, but he wasn't a coward. Oh. But it was from this period of my life where I still believed more or less the official narrative about war generally and World War II in particular. And I thought that we were the goodies. We, the Allies, were the goodies, and the Germans were the baddies, and that we beat Hitler and I'm not sure whether any of that is actually true anymore. But Operation Market Garden, I think, is a particularly interesting episode in World War II. And even if you take the normie the court historian version of history, even if you watch a film like A Bridge Too Far, you realize that there was stuff that happened during Market Garden that made no sense. And there's one classic moment in the movie which was inaccurate in some ways, and they had the wrong kind of tanks and stuff going for the bridge and etc. But there were some things they got right, and one of them was the reconnaissance flight organized by Brian Urquhart, who sent a Spitfire over to photograph the area where airborne were about to land, and he spotted some armor, or an SS, I think it was an SS tank unit lurking in the woods.
It was an SS Panzer Corps. Two divisions in recuperation, just having a little bit of a rest. Yeah.
Right. Well, and of course, that's not really what you want as a paratrooper, or indeed as a glider unit. You don't want to be landing on top of armor when you are lightly. Obviously, you're limited by the amount you can carry on a parachute. Not very much. You've got small weaponry only. That, and yet the operation went ahead.
There's another side to that, because there were also ultra decrypts as well, which have now come to light, which said exactly the same. So it wasn't just this one Spitfire. At the highest intelligence levels, the British Army knew that there was these SS Panzer Corps sitting there, the 9th and 10th SS Panzer Division, plus a whole load of other units hanging around, just resting around Arnhem, just, you know, pretty much where these guys were going to drop with their light weapons, as you say, and a few jeeps, things like that, a bit of artillery, a couple of light anti-tank guns, but certainly nothing that could deal with an SS Panzer Division or two.
No, and there was Panzer Lehr as well, wasn't there? Panzer Lehr is a training unit. So crack Panzer unit. Before I've whetted everyone's appetite. I mean, if you're a military history buff, this will be very interesting, this stuff. But before we go there, I wanted to find out a bit more about you, Tony, because you are that very rare thing, a BBC journalist who went to the, well, I suppose they would consider it the dark side. I consider it the good side. Yeah. I mean, we in Awake World associate the BBC with lies, with propaganda, mm-hmm. with dodgy dealings, with Mariana Spring and her disinformation department designed to root out evil conspiracy theorists wherever they lurk. And here you are, or were, a BBC man. So tell me, what was it that what turned you against the BBC narrative?
Well, maybe what drew me to do radio journalism in the first place was this just understanding, as in my 20s, that the family business was in aviation. It was quite, you know, it was exciting when you were a teenager, you know, oh, airplanes everywhere. But actually, once you realise that flying a plane is just boring, actually going backwards and forwards, I wanted something which was going to test me every day and be an interesting job to keep my brain going. And it was obvious that journalism was the BBC was the place to be in the late 1980s. And I managed to get myself a job at Greater London Radio, which was a BBC newsroom in Marylebone High Street. And working there as a researcher, and it was a fantastic in fact, it was by far the best station in London, which is probably why it was nobbled in the 1990s. We had Johnny Walker, Tommy Vance, we had one of the youngest excellent news editor who and various other people I worked with there, who I still hear on places like the World Service, on the Home Service, on Radio 4, reading the news, this sort of thing. But it was just the hub of everything. And there was a sort of competition in the 80s, if you remember, between ITV and BBC. ITV and the commercial stations were doing quite well with Capital and Kenny Everett and people like this, but GLR was an attempt by the BBC to really take them on, and they did a fantastic job. Matthew Bannister was the manager there. We had Chris Morris doing a weekly 3-hour comedy show, which I also worked on there, and we really did feel that we were civil servants taking on the commercial sector very effectively, and we were covering everything. We were doing all sorts of international stories, so it wasn't just London, and it was probably one of the biggest newsrooms, production offices in the capital, so it was a great place to learn how to do things. And I was working there setting up interviews for the lunchtime news program, and it was all interspersed with music in between all the interviews. So it was, you know, it, to me, it was the quintessence. Anyone listening to GLR around about 1990 time would have known that that station was their station, that we were looking out for Londoners. Anyone up to no good, they were going to find out through us about it. If anyone could find out, we would find out about it and tell the capital. We were very well listened to. So that's how sort of how and when I got into doing this. But then I started working in the various other stations, like in Southampton, and in Wiltshire, in Swindon, and in Salisbury. And I was digging in with a couple of other freelancers into child sexual abuse in two children's homes in Salisbury, which were owned by the deputy leader of the Tory group on Salisbury District Council. This is around 1992. And from that point on, it was just like, we've got a bit of a problem with this Gosling fellow. And eventually they just said, we haven't got enough money to pay you anymore. And that's it. No more renewal contract. Bye bye. And so I did suspect that that might have had something to do with me being elbowed out. I mean, I didn't leave. It was just a question of no more.
That's
more money.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
This sort of makes sense to me. That, like me, you went into journalism because you wanted to find out the truth wherever it took you. And you thought, you believed the story about all those movies that show the intrepid reporter going out and risking everything to find out the truth, whatever personal cost. You probably also realized, as I did, that is not actually how it is. Oh. that you are rewarded if you stay within the Overton window.
Well, that has changed, James. That has definitely changed. There was a big change at the BBC and at ITV. So 1987, we had a director general by the name of Alistair Milne, who was really critical of the Thatcher government. In fact, they were putting out all sorts of what the Tories and the City of London decided were sedition, basically, to do with North. I mean, there was a very, very well known at the time panorama called Maggie's Militant Tendency, which was looking at far right, Neil Hamilton, people like this in the Conservative Party. And this was at the days of Labour militant, you know. So Panorama and Alistair Milne, as the Director General, was really standing up to the establishment in a similar sort of way to the Panorama with Diana was standing up to the royal family. That this was happening. And in 1987, Victor Rothschild spoke to the chairman of the BBC, and this is it was at the time Marmaduke Hussey, and it's in his autobiography, saying, can you sack the Director General? So this was actually instigated effectively.
Victor Rothschild, who was MI6.
Yes. Well, he was MI5 in World War II. In the Cold War, he was MI6. Yeah. And he was also, I think, the fifth man in the Russian spy ring. And that's Roland Perry's book about that, which if you haven't spoken to Roland, please do. But anyway, so this was he's a city operator, political operator. He was a Labour peer. But anyway, he was very much listened to by Margaret Thatcher. And anyway, Marmaduke Hussey was the chairman at the BBC, and his wife was the
lady in waiting,
correct, to the Queen. And Marmaduke was asked to sack the Director General. So they got rid of Alistair Milne. They brought in Michael Checkland, who was an accountant. He wasn't a program maker. And then we had John Burt. And from this to 87, you can see it all declining. Then we had Death on the Rock around about the same time, broadcast on Thames Television and all right across the ITV network about the SAS shoot to kill in Gibraltar.
Yes, and Gibraltar. Then the SAS killed some IRA who were planning an operation, but they were unarmed, and they shot them. They shot them dead. Back in those days, I was thinking IRA evil, why shouldn't we take
them
out?
Yeah, when you arrest them and you put them on trial and you jail them, but they couldn't be bothered. Anyway, it was a very good documentary this week, I think. It was Thames Television produced it, and they never forgave Thames TV. So in 1993, Thames lost the franchise. Now, they were the best. They were fantastic. They had Euston Films, who were making brilliant films like Riley, Ace of Spies. You know, I don't know if you know Sam Neill's just died, but none of the tributes I've seen have mentioned his best drama series, which he did for Euston Films and for Thames, called Riley, Ace of Spies. If you haven't seen it, it's a fantastic series. And so that's what Thatcher killed with the BBC by knifing Alistair Milne in the back, and ITV by killing off Thames. And, you know, the rest of it is history. I think what we've seen since is a sort of cabal, really, city cabal of accountants taking over television production houses right across the country. And that's why most of the TV drama, the documentaries we see are so anodyne nowadays.
Okay. Can I play slightly devil's advocate here? In that I agree up to a point with your thesis that the BBC had more integrity in the 90s when you were working there. That it ran programs which would never be allowed. It would never run now. For example, Death on the Rock, questioning a secret.
Well, that was ITV.
Sorry. Okay, that bad example. But the BBC did
Operation Gladio in 1993. They ran a 3-part series all about NATO bombing its way around Europe and trying to blame it
That's extraordinary.
On the Russians. You know,
what was that on? Panorama?
Time Watch.
Time Watch.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. That is the perfect example of a program that BBC would never make now.
No.
That Mariana Spring will be all over it as a terrible conspiracy theory. How dare one suggest that NATO was funding and organizing these sleeper units designed to commit terrorist atrocities in the name of the left, when really these were, and it was designed to generate fear in the populace. Lots of people were killed as a result of Operation. Lots of innocent people were slaughtered, weren't they? Operation Daddy. So the BBC covered that. I imagine it's quite hard to find those documentaries now. I bet they've been buried.
Well, they don't rebroadcast them, that's for sure. We get enough repeats, but this isn't. I mean, Vincenzo Vinciguerra was interviewed by Alan Frankovich in that film. He was a fascist in Italy who'd been recruited as part of this NATO network to carry out bomb attacks to blame on the left, the Red Brigades and people like that. It was called the Years of Lead in Italy, the strategy of tension. The idea is you create social tension as we see, for example, you could argue Northern Ireland was a part of this in order to bounce politicians, press, etc. into things that they wouldn't want otherwise to do. Said, Vincenzo Vinciguerra actually says in there, he says, in 1945, World War II ended and World War III began. And that's because he knew that the operations of the fascists in Italy, this is particularly the Americans, to destroy communism in the country, had begun immediately at the end of the war. So there were already battles between the partisans and the American occupiers of places like in northwest Italy. There were battles about who's going to control one of the cities between the partisans and the occupying American troops. So, you know, this is why he points to this being a sort of beginning, really, of the problems that we've got now straight after the Second World War.
Okay, let me just finish the point I was meandering my way towards, which is, yes, I can see that the BBC was better in the 1990s than it is now, but you must know, because you've spent as much time down the rabbit hole, well, probably more time down the rabbit hole than I have, that the BBC was always a deep state project. I mean, going right back to Lord Reith, when they were issuing the initially the radio licenses, they realised that this was too valuable a resource to be wasted on ordinary people. It was always a state propaganda device. So you give us as an example that documentary, Thatcher's militant tendency. Now, I'm not suggesting that Thatcher's militant tendency weren't about a bunch of wrong-uns, but so the whole notion of left and right, this is an artificial divide anyway. It's basically the deep state versus us. It wasn't like
in a way that's what that panorama says, you know. Says like, you know, forget all this left right stuff. Don't, you know, because it's actually the same both sides. There's a similar sort of extremism. You know, that there was also My Country Right or Wrong, which I think was a radio program which was really questioning everything that had been going on in Northern Ireland and the British Army's role there. These were programs being produced. So anyway, I think you're right. You know, it's never been perfect. We had Winston Churchill kept off the airwaves from the Home Service before World War II for 3 years by the BBC, even though he was saying, watch out for this Hitler guy, you know. He was kept away from...
Yeah, but he was a baddie.
Phones. Huh?
I mean, this is the thing. Once you go down the rabbit hole, particularly the World War II rabbit hole, you realise that the senior command it was chock full of wrong ones. But anyway, just briefly on your... trying to expose this these children's homes where child sexual abuse was going on, under the auspices of the establishment being part of these children's homes, that was your first moment where you realized that where you smelled a rat and you realised that the world is not...
I hit the glass ceiling, didn't I? I hit the glass ceiling. I didn't know at the time, but Edward Heath was also implicated in this sexual abuse of young men. You know, so he was living in Salisbury at the time. He was in Cathedral Close. In fact, we used to joke, if we had any visitors around, we'd take them past Ted Heath's house in by the Salisbury Cathedral. And if you walked up to the gates and you leant against them, I had a cigarette and started chatting or whatever, a soldier would step out from behind a pine tree and ask you to move back. So we used to trigger this, you know, just for a laugh on a Saturday night Salisbury. So you know, I have no idea whether that was why. Another possible reason I was elbowed out was because I'd been chatting with an old school friend of mine, Nick Land, who's now known as the father of accelerationism, now living in Shanghai. But he was up at Warwick University. At teaching philosophy at the time, and he was then booted out allegedly for feeding LSD to his philosophy students. But Nick was always known when we were at school as Nazi Nick. I was friends with him because he knew everything there was. He knew more than any of the teachers in the school, and I learned most of what I now know, a lot of what I now know from Nick at school. And so I remember chatting with him, and he was, oh, you're working for the BBC. Oh, God. He sounded really nervous, you know, so it may have been something to do. I've no idea why. But anyway, that was the end of my career. But I went into land rights after that in the 1990s. We did land occupations. I worked quite closely with George Monbiot, very closely, you know, in George's house in Oxford. And then after that, I got back into broadcasting because, I was squatting as well, but it was, to me, it's trying to share a good understanding and good production values, which I was taught by the BBC, and trying to get that out there, which is what I do every week on a 3.5-hour weekly podcast. So I've been doing that pretty much ever since. I do have a life, but, you know, that's what most of my effort goes into, is news production.
I didn't know about the Nick Land connection, or if I did, I've forgotten it. That's extraordinary, because Nick Land popped up on a podcast I did the other day with Ian Davis, right, who has written about the threat of technocracy. Yeah. And Nick Land is the philosopher behind NRX, which is the philosophical excuse, political philosophical excuse for all the really bad stuff that people like Peter Thiel are planning to do. We're going to become vassals in this global technate, aren't we?
Accelerationism, or as David Halpin coined it, Armageddonism. This idea that actually producing the biggest conflict that mankind has ever seen is going to be good because they can control the outcome of it. Huh?
A quick word from our sponsor,
Sina Crisps. I used to eat loads and loads of crisps in my normie days, and then, of course, I discovered that they're all cooked in toxic seed oils, and so I pretty much gave up. The people behind CNAP have come up with a brilliant idea of cooking crisps not in seed oils, but in coconut oil, so they're actually not harmful to you. And they also taste... good. Was that a good idea to eat my crisps in the middle of the advert? I'm not sure. Anyway, I just want to make something absolutely clear. Just because I'm starting to do crisp adverts doesn't mean I'm about to become the new Gary Lineker. That's a joke that will go completely over the head of non-British viewers, and I envy those who don't know who Gary Lineker is. They're organic, they are not ultra-processed food, no seed oils, and you can find them at www.cinacrisps, that's S for sugar, I-N-A, crisps.com.
Use the code James for 15% off your order.
So, again, I'm not Gary Lineker, and I envy those of you who don't know who Gary Lineker is. I'm advertising crisps, but they are good crisps. They taste good, and they're cooked in coconut oil. So check out Cina Crisps.
Use the code James, J-A-M-E-S, that's me, for 15% off your order.
Now, back to the Delling Pod.
I didn't know about the Nick Land connection, or if I did, I've forgotten it. That's extraordinary, because Nick Land popped up on a podcast I did the other day with Ian Davis, right, who has written about the threat of technocracy. Yeah. And Nick Land is the philosopher behind NRX, which is the philosophical excuse, political philosophical excuse for all the really bad stuff that people like Peter Thiel are planning to do. We're going to become vassals in this global technate, aren't we?
Accelerationism, or as David Halpin coined it, Armageddonism. This idea that actually producing the biggest conflict that mankind has ever seen is going to be good because they can control the outcome of it. Huh?
Worse is better.
Yeah. Nick was sort of like that. He had a dark sense of humor. I really love the guy, actually, because he was always very, he'd be very upfront and frank, you know, like no messing around. And he wouldn't dodge questions, which so many people in philosophical circles and want to keep their job, media, politics do all the time. But he wasn't. He was very direct. And, yes, he is very much part of this. And he was, you know what, he told me about the internet in, I'm trying to think which year it would be, about 1978, 79. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Oh, yeah, it's going to be the big communication thing of the future. Now, okay, so that is like at least 15 years before it ever became a thing. I mean, I don't know how he knew about it, but of course, people don't necessarily know his father was a director of Shell South Africa in the 80s, the 70s. This was not a popular thing to be with apartheid and all that. So he's also got a connection back to the South African fascists with Musk's grandfather, potentially. I mean, it looks as if a lot of these people were people who'd gone to South Africa during World War II, because this was the best place to go in the British Empire for anyone who was a fascist. And, you know, you could carry on being a fascist safely all that way away from the war.
Wow. Yeah, I think this is the case. When you look at these figures who attain seemingly random prominence, and you look back at their heritage and their early years and who their fathers were, and you realize actually these people were assigned their roles much earlier in life than we might have realized.
Well, I certainly felt that with Nick, that he got some sort of an education way before he ever came to our grammar school. But anyway, he gave me a fantastic education. I mean, in history, in war, in art a bit, not so much, but in psychology, philosophy, he knew it all. And he was, you know, okay, so the guy's a Nazi. It wasn't a very popular thing to be in the 1970s.
So he was brave, you're saying.
He was incredibly brainy. And I found myself, you know, in a weird way, because I mean, I became a Christian in the 90s, I suppose the early 1990s.
Hang on, I hope my wife gets that. No, go away. Phew.
I became a Christian in the early 1990s, and this was really because of Nick. You know, he'd got all these things going on in my head, and I got to 18. I'd just done my A levels, and I was thinking, look, what's the point in all this education I've just got? Excellent. I mean, we had one of the best physics masters in the world. He was one on the board of Imperial College, Martin Black, a brilliant Jewish physics master, had no messing around with all of this stuff we have today around science being settled. No, never settled. Don't even think about it. But so we had a very good education. But I'm thinking to myself, what is the point if you don't know if there's a God or not? You know, you're going through the whole rest of your life with no idea, and you could get it all completely wrong and waste your whole life. So I actually prayed at my A-level results time. I said, God, look, if you're out there, just come and say hello, you know, and I'll have a listen.
And did he? Did he say hello?
Well, six months later, in a weird way, he did, yes, because I'd got lost and missed with the other people I was with up in the Cairngorms in a storm. And the weather came down, and I was surrounded by mist up in a place called the Larrig Grew at Devil's Point, would you believe? And I was sitting on a rock thinking, I'm going to die here. I was starting to shiver, get hypothermia. And I prayed again. I said, look, God, if you're out there, I'm too young to die. Yeah. So I was put into this situation. God knows how I ended up there, James. You know, I can't. But anyway, so nothing happened, of course. And I could hardly see. You could hardly see your hand in front of your face. It was so thick cloud of mist. So I didn't know which way to go. No idea. And I couldn't see any cairns anywhere. You know, I was trying to follow the path. Anyway, so the clouds parted. Right. I'm not kidding you. And about half a mile or three quarters of a mile away, I saw a little bothy. I'm right, I can go for the bothy. Brilliant. And so I spent the next 2.5 hours going in that dead straight direction. I saw where the sun was. I just kept going across a river, the River Dee, I think it is, and up a rock face for about half an hour. And eventually I carried on. I got to the bothy and I got inside and I started warming up. There was a Dutch couple sitting in there going, what, God, what were you doing out in that, you know? And they had a fire going. So, and that's why I'm sitting here chatting to you today and not some body lying in the Larrig Grew.
What a great story. That's really good.
You can't really go back from that. Do you know what I mean? Once something like that's happened to you, okay, God, so you are out there. I can't argue, you know, with anyone that says there is a God in heaven. I know there is.
Brilliant. I think we should. Shall we go to Arnhem and let's just very, very, very briefly sketch out the, let's say, the official version, which is that in 1944, Montgomery hit on this crazy idea to drop an airborne division, 6 air airborne, behind enemy lines in the Netherlands, in order to capture the bridges over the Rhine and enable to take the Germans by surprise and enable a swift Allied advance, which would cut off the German access to, well, the industrial heartland in the Ruhr. It was going to be a brilliant coup de main, which would shorten the war by many months, 6 months or more. And as we know, the operation failed. That we've already mentioned the fact that there were two SS Panzer divisions sort of camped directly below the landing sites, so that when these paratroopers and glider troops landed in the drop zones, they fought a gallant fight. They took the bridge at Arnhem and held it for a while, but after a period, they were overwhelmed by the Germans. And there was a key moment, wasn't there? A key moment, which again appears in A Bridge Too Far, where there was the airborne force, 6th Airborne, and then there was 30 Corps, commanded by Brian Horrocks. And they were going to advance.
By the way, it's the 1st Airborne Division, not the 6th.
Sorry, 1st Airborne.
Were in Britain, ready to go, but they were never sent as reinforcements.
Yeah, 1st Airborne was, you're right, sorry. The 30 Corps, commanded by Brian Horrocks, was going to advance towards the bridges and relieve the bridgehead. And this had tanks in it. And at the spearhead, and this is quite interesting, the spearhead of the 30 Corps advance was a grenadier, am I right? Grenadier tank unit commanded by one Captain Carrington.
Correct.
Captain Peter Carrington. And there's a very famous scene in the movie where the American paratroopers, who I think were from 82nd Airborne,
That's right. Was it 101st? Played by 82nd Airborne. Robert Redford played Moffat Burris, who was the captain who confronted Carrington. Yeah,
they'd taken the bridge at Nijmegen. Very heroically, it was one where they paddled across the river, yeah. and they anyway under heavy fire. And they said, right, guys, go and rescue our airborne brothers, our British and Polish airborne brothers holding out at Arnhem. They haven't got much supplies left. We need to rescue them. And Carrington says, no, it's too dangerous, or something similar. He says, it's too dangerous. We've been given orders. We can't advance.
We can't advance without orders, is what you said. And by the way, the Poles never dropped at this point. They were dropped afterwards in the wrong place. This was incredibly botched. So, I mean, what I've looked at to do with this battle, and I did do a talk over, I think it was in 2017 in Oosterbeek, which is where the Hexenkessel was, the Witch's Cauldron, where the British were surrounded in Arnhem, the 1st Airborne. Yep. And which went down very well over there, and a lot of interesting extra information came out from the local population who'd been there in the battle. So this confrontation, you're quite right. Moffat Burris and the 82nd had just crossed in a salt river crossing. Lots of their men had been shot by the Germans who were on the north side of the River Vaal at Nijmegen. And also another person that knows a lot about this is Tim Sanders. He's a military historian, lives in Warminster, and he's written the book on the Nijmegen part of this battle. So the question is, why did the British not carry on at this point? You know, Moffat Burrows had just been involved in cutting the wires to detonate the bridge. So the Germans were hoping, as soon as the first tanks came across the bridge, Carrington and his friends, who I imagine would have been rather nervous in their tank going across there, they had a bridge wired to blow it up. But Moffat Burrows and his men had just snipped the wires, so they couldn't blow the bridge up. And there were a whole load of orders saying that this sort of thing must happen. Hitler had told everyone, we must destroy the bridges, blah blah blah. But there were counter orders from Bormann, his private secretary, saying, no, don't leave it. We want to concentrate on fighting the Russians on the Eastern Front. But anyway, that's another angle to it. But the fact is that there was nothing to stop the Grenadier Guards, the Sherman tanks, 30 Corps, and the Grenadier Guards going down the road. It was around about 15-minute drive to Arnhem to literally relieve the pressure at the bridge.
They could have relieved the airborne.
The reason we know that there was nothing there is the work of he wrote a book called It Never Snows in September. He was a colonel in the British Army, and he spoke to
Robert Kershaw.
Yeah, he spoke to Heinz Hamel, who was I think it was the 10th SS Panzer Division general, who after the war, and he said it was really frustrating because if you'd have carried on, there was nothing to stop you, and he even produced the artillery map which showed the positions of the troops at the time. They hadn't managed to get past Arnhem. And so all they had was some light, not even infantry, police units on that road. Those tanks would have been able to carry straight on. Now, there were a couple of Panzerfausts actually at the at near the bridge. Sergeant Robinson dealt with them, and he came back. But they were – so the question is, who was it and why were they not told to carry on? In a way, you know, Monty's plan here was a very sound one if it had been allowed to continue and to unfold in the way that it was supposed to. But it wasn't allowed to because Carrington kept back. I mean, this idea of getting across the Rhine meant a lot because it was a bridgehead into the Ruhr. This meant – I mean, sorry, think about
– sorry, I was going to get rid of this because it's too annoying. I'll come back.
Ted? Ted? I can't get to it. No, I can now. He's gone. All right. I've got it. Yeah, okay. Oh, it's not enough. Oh, this is annoying. Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So.
Sorry about.
I was just doing a little diversion into talking about the Ruhr and why it was important to get across the Rhine. I mean,
what you're saying is brilliant. I just want you to sort of tell it in the right order. So at the moment we've got, if you look at court history, official history, the on D, if you like, about Market Garden is it was always doomed to failure. It was a sort of quixotic and sort of impetuous scheme by an overpromoted Montgomery who was not as good as he thought he was, and he concocted this crazy scheme, and it fell apart because it was always going to fall apart.
Well, it wasn't, because it was a very good. If you think about, I mean, my uncle was a Lancaster pilot. I never knew. He was shot down. They were spending a lot of their effort bombing the Ruhr because they knew the Ruhr was the key to winning the war, both for the Russians as well. The Russians were very, by the way, very grateful for Bomber Command because it was a lot of the equipment was going to the Eastern Front too that we were destroying in the Bomber Command raids. But, you know, this was part of that. Once you get across the Rhine, suddenly the Germans have to completely reorganize their defenses to defend the Ruhr, bring divisions from the Eastern Front, Western Front, move everything around. It's a major, major headache. So Monty was completely correct in attempting to do this. But he was thwarted by lower people. Who knows? Maybe even he was in on it. But certainly there was an attempt to, and it was they very nearly did. I mean, they very nearly did succeed in holding on to the bridge at Arnhem.
Well, this is the thing. I was going to say that what's extraordinary is, given the handicaps that were imposed on this operation, and you mentioned some other things in your book on the subject, traitors of Arnhem. You point out there were other problems, for example, that. Rather than drop all the men in one day, they did it over a period of 2 days, thus losing the element of surprise, and they couldn't concentrate their forces, and troops had to be wasted guarding the landing fields for the second day, and so on. So the whole point about parachute operations is that they're meant to be swift in order to take advantage of
well,
the shock.
Well, there was no element of surprise. That was part of the problem, is that Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was a former SS officer, had been in on the planning. In fact, there's pictures of him peering over Montgomery and Horrocks' shoulder at the map of the plan of the mission. And he'd managed to get King Kong, Christian Lindemans, who was an Abwehr agent, through a couple of days before into Eindhoven. And so the Abwehr in Eindhoven knew that this operation was about to take place. They didn't need to have any other warning than that. They knew it, they were expecting it. And so there was
no... Can you tell me a bit more about Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands? I mean, he's a name that crops up a lot. Wasn't he involved in the foundation of the World Wildlife Fund?
And the Bilderberg Conference, right?
Okay, so we'll come to that. But he founded the WWF with Prince Philip. But how come he's known as Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands when he was in the SS? And he was German, wasn't he?
He was German aristocracy that married into, before the war, married into the Dutch royal family. But, I mean, he was clearly...
He married a Dutch... Who did he marry? Was it Beatrix?
It was Juliana, I think.
Juliana.
It was Beatrix. So Juliana apparently went a bit crazy towards the end. But, he was working for the Germans. The Americans knew this. They would have nothing to do with him. But the British Army, for some reason, decided, we trust Bernhard and embraced him. You know, so he was able to pull a few tricks and make sure that the Germans knew that this is something I found out through a guy called Barry Wynn, who was in the SAS after the war. He was a film producer. He was also the PR man for ABC television during the first couple of series of The Avengers. He was doing all their PR in London. Barry explained to me he'd met this guy called Colonel Pinto, who was an intelligence officer who had been trying to arrest Lindemans just before he disappeared off to Eindhoven to tell them about Arnhem. And there's a whole book about that in the 1950s by Colonel Pinto, and he was he did a whole series on the BBC Home Service about intelligence operations during the war, but this has been since forgotten about. But Barry met him and knew him, so he told me this was the guy. He told me all about why we lost the Battle of Arnhem, because they'd sent this guy in beforehand. Now, this is an example, this whole battle is an example of how history can be completely massaged to protect traitors, no less, that like Peter Carrington and others that had made sure that the people at the bridge at Arnhem never got the relief they needed.
Okay, you keep dropping in too many exciting bits that I want to follow up later on, but I think we need to establish our terms and our characters, because I know all this and you know all this, but I'm trying to help audience sort of follow the story exactly. So you've got Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was in the SS in 1937, I think, and he was a German aristocrat, married the Dutch queen. You would think, wouldn't you, that British intelligence would be slightly wary of this guy who was only an ally by marriage and had been actually in the SS, and yet was seemingly given carte blanche to study the plans for the landings, for example. I mean, was he not vetted?
Meanwhile, Brian Urquhart, who is elbowed out, of the planning process, because he's saying, no, this is not going to work. You know, so there's definitely something going on in the planning of Market Garden, which is, doesn't make any military sense. You know, so you're bringing in the enemy into the planning through Bernhard, and you're booting out your intelligence officer that's saying, no, don't do it, because this is going to be a disaster. The SS are sitting there, look. So something very fishy. And I imagine that was part of the main figure, in fact, is Boy Browning. He was the general in charge of the whole operation on supposedly, well, on both sides, in charge of the ground troops and the airborne troops. Or I think maybe he was just supposed to be in charge of the three airborne divisions. He was the one that sent the 82nd Airborne Division off in the wrong direction to the Grosbeek Heights when they should have been trying to take the Nijmegen Bridge. And complete ruse, a complete load of nonsense, sent them off there. And so there was a delay in taking the bridge at Nijmegen. They should have been pouncing straight on it, but Browning sent them in the wrong direction.
So Boy Browning was married to Daphne du Maurier, the woman who wrote Rebecca. She was a very successful, she was wealthy in her own right because she came from the du Maurier cigarette family. So he was very comfortably off. He was probably he was a sort of safe husband to have. You know, he probably let her get on with her writing life while he did what is, and he's probably good looking and well connected, but ultimately he was a cipher. Do you think he was chosen for the job in order because they wanted somebody a bit crap to mastermind?
Well, I think they wanted someone who would sabotage the entire thing. You know, that seems to be why. I mean, if you look at Urquhart, who was the general in charge of the 1st Airborne Division, he was fairly green. I mean, he was also known as someone who was quite pliable. So he wouldn't have been questioning anything that he was told by Browning, who was his senior officer. And so, you know, this, I mean, it looks to me as if this whole operation was designed to help the Germans survive an extra maybe 2 or 3 months. They did say that if they crossed the Rhine at this point, that the war could be over by Christmas, and that was because of the threat to the Ruhr. I mean, the Ruhr is the industrial heartland, which is building all the equipment to fight the war, and if that is compromised by a Rhine crossing, you know, it could mean that's it, that everything to collapse.
They didn't. Someone somewhere did not want this operation to succeed, and I'm just trying to find out what you can tell me about how they sabotaged it at various stages. So you've got Boy Browning, the overall commander of this mission, being chosen because he's a bit crap, and he was all over the shop. But who would have appointed him? I mean, if this was Montgomery's brainchild, surely Montgomery would have made the appointment.
I'm not sure who would make the appointment. I don't honestly know that. But he was, I would say more than that, he was sending troops off in the wrong directions. He was failing to call for reinforcements at the wrong. He was, you know, he was actually saying there were reinforcements being offered to him and he was saying no. So, you know, he's more than just incompetent, it seems to me. You know, if he actually wants to have a successful mission, he's making all sorts of decisions which mean that's impossible. I mean, for example, where the Polish was sent was completely the wrong place. I mean, they could have been there to help hold the bridge, but they weren't put in a position where they couldn't do that. And then they were blamed for the failure of the battle by Browning and others. He ended up in a real mess, by the way, in the later years after the war as an alcoholic. And, you know, he was in a bit of a mess as an individual. I've read various reports about, you know, is this guy? He's all over the place, you know, and he was certainly nothing to write home about. So he's one of the traitors. But look, the key thing is why? Why would they not want to win the battle? And the answer I think I've uncovered is that there were deals being done between the British and the Nazis over the massive Nazi wealth that they got during the Second World War, which was mostly squirreled away in Switzerland, some of it too in Argentina. And they were already in train negotiations. If you go back to the month before Market Garden, at the Red House meeting in August in Strasbourg, I think it was. Yeah, Strasbourg. Which Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary, set up but never actually attended. Everything was being set in train there for the financial success of Germany after the war. So the rejuvenation and rebuilding of Germany, and also the success of German companies in other countries and multinational companies. And this was a very important meeting where they were saying, right, we've lost the war, but we're not going to lose our wealth, and we're going to make sure we keep. That was all a month before Market Garden. So I would suggest to you that the reason that Market Garden was sabotaged was to make sure that there was enough time to carry forward these processes of flight capital, moving it out from Germany, getting everything out of Germany that was necessary, including, by the way, a lot of technology, high-tech stuff, which they wanted to, they were saying initially they wanted to give to the Japanese, but then eventually ended up going to the Americans, such as nuclear weapons technology, this sort of thing. So that was all set in train as a negotiation. And we know, everyone knows about Operation Paperclip, don't they? Everyone's heard about this. This was being written about in the 1970s, 1980s, which is the American deals with the Nazis, whereby loads of SS people went to the States. They went to this new central...
Paperclip.
Went to the new Central Intelligence Agency. So as the Cold War was being fought, most of the intelligence officers that were dealing with the Soviet Union were ex-SS, an ex-Gestapo from the Eastern Front, Reinhard Gehlen and his pals. So this is quite well known amongst people that
look at
such things. But what's much less well known, and which is what my book's about, is about the British links between, the highest level links between Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary, and Churchill's private secretary back here in London, who was Desmond Morton, Major Desmond Morton. And these two had been communicating, I think, for a long time. But possibly, I mean, if you look at what's happened with Adolf Hitler, bit by bit during the war, various of his close allies and friends disappeared, went out, didn't they? Rudolf Hess, who'd been a friend of Hitler's for many years, just mysteriously got into a plane and flew to Scotland, and he's no longer around with Hitler. Reinhard Heydrich, who was Hitler's chosen successor, he was assassinated. And so, in a way, Bormann was the only one left, you know, one of his old friends, and he really did trust him, and he controlled access to Hitler. So this relationship, I think, between Morton and Bormann is not really known about, and we can see through this amazing novel, because some say it was, this is a book, Op JB, by John Ainsworth Davis under the pen name Christopher Crichton, looks at this relationship in terms of Ian Fleming and Naval Intelligence sending a crew into Berlin at exactly the time of the end of the Second World War, April, May 1945, and bringing Bormann out through the canals, through Berlin, through the Russian sector, and to the British sector at Verben, where Bormann is then handed over to Desmond Morton. And, of course, Bormann is important because he is the signatory to all the bank accounts, everything. And this is all detailed in the book, including the role of Ian Fleming. And Fleming's role is interesting in that, if you remember, in the 1950s, Fleming was known as, in the early 50s and late 40s, he hit the bottle. And he had apparently had a conversation with Dennis Wheatley, the novelist, and he said, look, don't let it get to you, all this terrible stuff that happened at the end of the war. Write novels about it, because if you write it as fiction, they can't touch you. Which is when Fleming then started to pen these Bond novels, if you notice. And he was getting it out of his system by writing. In Moonraker, he writes all about the Nazis, for example. But he was writing about this whole idea of world domination, you know, the Dr. No phrase with Sean Connery, same old dream. And this idea that there's another force out there which is operating in these wars to gain power through war, which is what I think we're even still seeing today with the conflict with the Russians, with the conflict with Iran, this sort of thing, which is still going on. There is a third force out there which is looking to manipulate things from behind the scenes. So that's what my book is really about. It's making those connections between, and you know, I wanted to write about the Bilderbergers for years. I first set up a website about them in 1995-1996, which was just secret press releases that said not for publication from the Bilderbergers, listing all of the participants. And I mean, this is effectively a fascist international, but Prince Bernhard was the chairman of the Bilderberg conference for the first 20 years until the Lockheed scandal, and he had to resign. But this, it seems to me, has been the centre of power. It's a sort of political lobby group for the NATO arms industry and the NATO collective, which has been putting their candidates into various political, you know, for example, Clinton went to the Bilderberg before, just before he became the Democratic nominee for president in the States. Tony Blair went to the Bilderberg just before he became Labour leader. And we've seen many of the people come up. You know, it's a good idea to look at Bilderberg. Who's going to be the next? Ursula von der Leyen. She was sitting at the top table when I was in Dresden in 2016 with Henry Kissinger. And then, of course, she then becomes the president of Europe. So this is, it seems to me, is, you know, we're not dealing with a nationalist fascist thing anymore, which we were in Italy and Germany in the World War II. We're dealing with a fascist international, certainly in Europe and the United States these days. And Bilderberg represents that. But it's that connection between people like Carrington, and there are several others, from the Second World War, from deals done. I mean, effectively, the Battle of Arnhem was a Nazi victory. And if you go there any September, you can see it's like a party. And I'm thinking, why are you partying for a Nazi victory here? And of course, the answer is that the Nazis, in many ways, did win the financial war.
They won. Yes. I'm glad you took us back to Arnhem, because I feel we're not finished with it yet, and I do want to come back to Bilderberg, because obviously it is significant. But the reason I was pressing you for details on all the different characters involved, Boy Browning, for example, is I'm trying to work out just how big a conspiracy this was. Who must have been in on it? So you're saying, well, Browning, the commander of the operation, obviously, whoever appointed Browning to sabotage it. Now, there's the story about the crystals in the wireless sets, which prevented headquarters, Browning's HQ, from communicating with the men in the field. Would you consider that might be sabotage by MI5, say? I mean, that would be quite easy to do, wouldn't it?
I did speak to Tony Hibbert about that. He was the brigade major at the bridge in Arnhem, and he said that we could get through. I mean, they did get through occasionally, and they were telling the first airborne headquarters whereabouts the clear routes were, but they weren't listening. It was Urquhart was not there at the headquarters, who was supposed to be the general in charge. It was a colonel that took the call, and he just wouldn't send the troops down the route that they had told them was the right route. I think he said Lion route is free, and it was free, but they didn't send the troops down there. They were too busy dealing with the Germans on the edge of the city, I guess, and trying to keep the drop zones clear. So that was a major problem. Okay, so there may have been jamming going on. Of course, the Germans were quite able to do that sort of thing, so it may not have been the crystals in the radios, but there were communication problems on lots of levels. So if you're radioing your headquarters and telling them this route to get to the center of Arnhem is free, and they're busy dealing with Germans who are attacking them from the opposite direction, they're not necessarily going to take your advice. And so they would also be wondering, is there any point in us trying to get to the bridge if it already looks like we've lost this battle? I think it was, I can't remember the name of the colonel who took that radio message from Tony. I mean, remember Colonel Frost, who was the colonel on the bridge, he shook his fist at one of these reunions. I think it was back in the 1990s when he was still alive, shook his fist at the reunion. Everyone was stood there. He was there, and he broke ranks, and he shouted out at one of the reunions. I remember someone who told me who was there. What a load of beep, beep, beep. Yeah. This is, you guys didn't come down the road. You could easily have come down here, and this was, because he knew that they could hear the guns at Nijmegen, right? And they knew
who was he shaking his fist at. Sorry,
he was shaking his fist at the establishment, the British establishment. Carrington, particularly, was shaking his fist at. He was at the ceremony, and Carrington didn't really want to go into it and talk about it, obviously. But Frost was really annoyed that they were having this big ceremony about a version of events which he didn't recognise at all. So this did break out a bit after the Second World War in these various reunions. The truth was did get a little bit of a hearing, and they knew that they could. They were expecting the tanks to arrive at any time at the bridge, which is why they were fighting virtually to the last man. And the crazy thing is, like, literally an hour after the bridge fell, that's when Carrington got his order. Okay. Advance now. I'm literally an hour afterwards. So what you've then got is a blocking line, right? Because the Germans have brought all the tanks up and the anti-tank guns and the assault guns, and they're ready. you know, for the tanks to come along. So there was a blocking line by that point, and I think it was 12 hours that they had, they could have got to the bridge, but they just didn't, and they sat there for 12 hours. At the end of that 12 hours, once the bridge had fallen, then the orders came down the line. Okay, yeah. We can go forward now. Once now we've lost the battle, let's go.
Yeah, yeah. So again, the normie stroke court history version of this, the decision not to advance, is that you know what an 88 millimeter gun can do it to a Sherman tank, and they were advancing on the top of a kind of a berm, weren't they? There was a sort of there was flooded land either side, and tanks were advancing down an exposed single track. All it would take would be one 88.
Yeah, but there weren't any. There weren't any.
No. I'm just. Yeah. I know this, but I'm just. This is the official version.
Yeah.
And the official version also would go, but how were they to know? How could they know that there were no 88s? But we know from the movie, for example, that 82nd Airborne would have been quite happy to have accompanied the tanks as they went down the road and taken out any 88 millimeter guns that happened to be there. So it was clearly a fix, and it's very, very interesting that the guy in the lead tank, or second lead, because I think you mentioned Sergeant Robinson was in the lead tank, was commanded by this guy, Peter Carrington, later Lord Carrington, later one of Margaret, later Defence Minister under Margaret Thatcher.
During Bloody Sunday, he was Defence Secretary during Bloody Sunday when that happened.
Carrington has a very, very murky background. I don't know how much of this you know. That you know where the Carringtons made their name. The Carringtons made their name during the Crusades, where one of Carrington's ancestors, I think it was the siege of Acre, he stormed the ramparts in an incredibly heroic. Maybe it was another place, but anyway, he was the forlorn hope that stormed the ramparts and enabled the Crusaders to take this citadel. And this is all part of the Carrington family history. The Carringtons are also related to one of their ancestors, was involved in the Scilly Islands in Tresco. They married into that family that live on Tresco, and there's sort of dodgy stuff going on there somewhere. But Carrington, have you looked into Carrington's role in the Troubles? The so-called Troubles in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, he was
instrumental. Carrington was instrumental. Carrington, you talked about divide and rule, about they were not organic. It wasn't that Catholics and Protestants wanted to beat the hell out of each other because it's what Catholics and Protestants do. This whole thing was orchestrated, and I believe the person who orchestrated it was Lord Carrington, who was also, were you aware that he's a warlock?
No.
Although there is a very, very senior satanic.
There is a picture of him with a big pair of scissors in the background, gigantic carved pair of scissors. I remember, I think that was in the Telegraph probably 20 years ago.
Carrington was very, very high in the satanic church. I mean, you know, he was sort of Barack Obama level in the
satanic
church.
So how do you know that?
Because this is the stuff I make my business to find out. I read a very good essay by some. I've been trying to get him onto the podcast. He's been so far. He's been bloody useless at getting back to me. What's his name? Patrick O'Carroll.
Oh, okay, all right.
Who wrote this incredibly detailed essay on the involvement on how MI5 basically ran, or MI6 basically ran the Troubles. They ran both sides, so they controlled the IRA, and they controlled the British military and the prods. But it's interesting that somebody who was so instrumental in the failure of the Arnhem operation was also later on ran the Troubles, and later became defense secretary and a kind of eminence grise in the Thatcher cabinet.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and also secretary general of NATO, of course, which is like the top of, you know, all of these jobs. So, and of course, chairman of the Bilderbergs. So he's been everywhere almost, really. And I think, you know, this, what it does, what you're explaining to me, and I'm not sure about this Warlock stuff, but it's clear he had a very big role in starting the Troubles. And the Troubles were finished, by the way, by three massive bombs in the City of London, which finally brought an end to it all, where very few people were actually killed, but £1 billion each were damage was done. This is when I was at the BBC, and to these massive buildings at Canary Wharf, Bishopsgate, etc.
What was the purpose of that, would you say? Why would you bring the war to an end by blowing up the city?
Well, this was the IRA doing this. They realised that actually the problem was the City of London, and the problem was the people with the money, and that if they made it hurt for them, then that maybe they would actually start taking some of these negotiations to end the conflict seriously, and they did. So, I mean, Carrington, let's have a look at where is power? Where really is power? So you can look at this, you know, the mindset, this kind of Luciferian mindset of I'm a god, there is no god, but I'm in charge, I can do what I want, and I want more and more power. I have the power to destroy, to kill, and I can use that power to gain more power. So that's the sort of, you know, what's going on in their minds. But also you have to look, I think, at the mechanisms. Where is politics? Where are decisions really made? How is it decided that we have draconian laws brought in the EU and Britain simultaneously to prohibit any promotion, right? Or that is to say, facts that might be pro-Russia in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. This is because there is no democracy. These decisions are being made in elite committees and then being just... And that's, I would suggest, is where Carrington operated. He would be on a elite committee. Let's look. The easiest place to look is Italy in the 1980s, back to Italy again, is the P2 scandal showed that Licio Gelli, the fascist, was running Italy from his big country house with a committee made up of bankers, top politicians, political apparatchiks, media owners, police and army chiefs. Effectively, it was a sort of shadow government. Masonic shadow government, the P2 propaganda duo scandal, and they even had the Prime Minister Aldo Moro kidnapped and assassinated, and tried to blame it on the Russians, because they didn't want to have the communists coming into a coalition government in Italy. This is all in the 1980s, but it was absolutely ripped apart in the P2 scandal. You could see exactly how Italy was really being run during those years by looking into that. And I think that's how most of the Western countries are actually run. And it's why we feel like our vote doesn't really count or make a difference, because these people are, look at Andy Burnham, the way he's being brought in. Of course, there has to be an election within the Labour Party, the Parliamentary Labour Party and the Labour membership, to who's going to take over from Starmer. But no, someone else has decided who's going to take over from Starmer. We've had to make a field by-election, and Andy Burnham is just being spatchcocked in, certainly not by any kind of democratic process. And so that's how I think this works in terms of, you know, the sort of mechanisms. So there's the three things. It's the actual power structure, the mindset, and the mechanisms. The mechanisms, I think, are through cults and what you might consider to be either witchcraft, covens, lodges, small groups of 13. You'll have a top group, and then you'll have other groups, and they can be all sorts of different types of cult, any cult you wanted. You might even have a triad as one of these cults. But that's how these things are done, and I do explain some of this in my other book, which is called The Siege of Heaven Reader, which is really a sort of gazetteer of lots of different articles of conspiracy theories and, well, it's all sorts, actually, from all sorts of, but they're all good sourced books, right the way back to, you know, from the Princess Diana assassination, right the way back to medieval times and the English Civil War. And so what I've done is I've taken extracts from books and put them all together in this thing called The Siege of Heaven Reader, which also details some of the ways that cults and, well, I mean, that's the easiest way to describe them. You know, you swear an oath to the cult and you're no longer fit for any kind of public service because you're not loyal to anything except the cult. And you can lie in public, no problem. You're a member of a cult. And it's, it could be a Zionist group. It could be a witchcraft group. It could be a satanic group. It could be a Masonic group. But that's the actual power structure, I think, which is really there operating behind the scenes and which Carrington was obviously quite a major part.
Yes, I think that sounds to me like another, we should do a separate podcast on that. I must read that book because, I mean, I'd love to know, you know, more about the death of Princess Di and stuff, but not now because it's like we're approaching the end of this podcast and it's just like, but we should definitely go back to Bilderberg because I, like you, I've been... or been to or seen the site of the Bilderberg Hotel, which is in Osterbeek, isn't it?
Well, this is what is the sort of hinge of the book, really, is that the Bilderberg, everyone was, I mean, I was approached by Roger van Zwanenburg at Pluto Press in 2000. He said, can you write me a book on the Bilderbergs? And I'm like, don't know enough, Roger, sorry. And it's slowly but surely, it's bits and pieces have come out. And I've now made this connection between the Bilderberg Hotel was chosen because it was right in this witch's cauldron, which is what the soldiers nicknamed the Hexenkessel, the pocket where the 1st Airborne Division had been hemmed in by the SS, and they were just massacring them. I heard from the locals in Osterbeek when I did my talk there that the British soldiers were drinking it. They had no water at all. They were desperately trying to get siphoned water out of the central heating systems in some of the houses, which were already, you know, in a terrible state. They were having to drink that because there was no supplies by Browning being dropped into the right place. There was nothing. It was like that the British armed forces at the time were collaborating with the Nazis to make sure this battle was lost. So they were dropping the supplies from the Dakotas, supply drops. That was all, you know, in these pods, but it was all going in the wrong place. They weren't even dropping them where the British were. And so this Bilderberg conference started in the Hexenkessel in Osterbeek. And this is their rather sick in joke, I think, that the Bilderbergers hope no one would ever figure out. And maybe it is too late to really make much of a difference figuring it out this time. This amount of time after it, that's why they chose there, because this was one of their great little victories. This is where the Nazis got in bed with the British through Desmond Morton and his pals and Carrington and others, whoever they might be, I have no idea, through secret society networks, cult networks, in order to make sure the Nazis had enough time to implement their post-war Fourth Reich financial empire plan, which it seems to me is mostly what we're dealing with today, a financial Fourth Reich, where you don't need a tank to do anything. You just use a bank to either destroy someone, debank someone, finance a massive legal campaign to destroy them, buy up a media company that they're working for, sack them, bribe someone to sack them. And money seems to be the mechanism which is being used now, not over military force, but a kind of financial Fourth Reich. And this was quite important to them in September 1944, that this was all put in place properly after this Red House meeting a month previously. And so that's why I think people like Fleming were rather upset at the end of the war that maybe that they'd been doing things that they weren't that proud of, but they couldn't speak about them because of the Official Secrets Act. But there is another one other book I'd like to mention in connection with Arnhem, and that is Paul Manning. He did a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, where he shows what Bormann got up to after he'd come to Britain and he'd gone over to Argentina. He was living in Buenos Aires and Paraguay. And he was discovered by Stuart Stephen. I don't know if you've ever seen that headline in the Saturday Daily Express in 1972, I think it was. Martin Bormann alive, because he'd been lost ever since the Second World War. They thought, oh, he's been killed. But they found him. They photographed him. Ladislaus Fraga, the author of Aftermath, was a Hungarian photographer, photographed Bormann in Buenos Aires as a 70-year-old or something. And this was in the sort of page three or whatever of the Daily Express. And so it was quite clear and obvious that Bormann was still there. Manning had written a book which was published in the mid-1980s. He was a brilliant CBS journalist who'd been over in Europe reporting for the American audience on the Flying Fortresses bombing, daylight bombing raids on Nazi Germany during the war. And Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, was his swan song, really, his final novel. Book. And he explains over in Buenos Aires, Bormann had spent his time in the late 40s and early 50s creating 750 companies. And those 750 companies, all the money from through Switzerland and through Desmond Morton, from the Nazi loot of the Second World War, they'd looted the whole of Europe, went through Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm, which was the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York. They laundered the cash, and it was injected into these 750 businesses by Bormann in Buenos Aires. And as the very clever move was, as chairman of these companies, almost all of them, they were chosen to be a Jewish chairman. Usually a Zionist, almost always a Zionist, but a Jewish chairman, in order to hide the fact that it was Nazi wealth that had started the business. So Manning's book is really interesting, really important. And together with OpJB, which is a sort of first installment of what happened with Martin Bormann after the war, I think these are two very important bits of history, which have, there's been a big attempts to bury, but great journalism and great writing in order to make sure that at least there is a little bit of truth. If you're prepared to do a jigsaw puzzle, you can see what's been going on here, which is this Fourth Reich being created. And I remember speaking to a guy called Idris Francis before he died. He was part of UKIP back before the Tommy Robinson attempt to take it over. And Idris, his uncle was a major at Nuremberg. He was escorting Nazi war criminals around in Nuremberg, obviously at gunpoint. But this German general or colonel turned and said to him, he said, "This time you have beaten us for the second time, but next time we will win, and you won't know what's happening until it's all over." And this chilled him, and he scribbled it down dutifully and passed it on to his nephew. And so I think there is a tremendous amount of evidence that there was a deal being done, and this is really what my book details. And many people throw doubt upon OpJB. They say this is rubbish. I met his wife, Greta. I met her in North London, had a good long chat with her, sat at John's piano, and had a real good, which she completely convinced me that it was all true, that he was an agent. He'd been sent into Germany and done all the things that he said he'd done and worked with Fleming, etc. And so yeah. I had really no doubt about that after meeting her. And there's a couple of other things which made me. And of course, you know, no journalist would write a book, like I said to Roger, unless you can actually stand it up. What is this we're dealing with today is effectively a fascist international run by Bilderbergers, look at Le Cercle, for example, another Bilderberg-like organization.
A kind of libertarian sort of flavor.
Nadim Zahawi, chairman of Le Cercle.
Nadim Zahawi.
Yeah, so he's now moved into Nigel Farage's party, whatever it happens to be at the time, which I think is Reform UK. There he could potentially be the next government. And it's horrible to see the death of Anne Widdecombe, who potentially could have been a senior minister in the next government. Or even a prime minister. You know, it's not impossible that she would have been chosen by the UKIP people as a good prime minister. So
yeah,
you know, we're not dealing with fascist nationalism anymore. We're dealing with the fascist international, and some people find that difficult to understand.
It's interesting that some of the names that have been cropping up in the in this conversation. I mean, Daphne du Maurier. Do you know the story, by the way, before I forget, that, that it was Daphne du Maurier who chose the maroon colour for the berets of the airborne forces?
No, I didn't know that. No, no. They were,
but anyway,
I mean, he married into the right family, put it that way.
He married into the right family. It's all about, it's all about connections. And you think about after the war, these we've talked about how Carrington, who was presumably perceived to have had a good war, as it was known, ended up as the Secretary General of NATO. People were sort of rewarded for their bad behaviour, or that Ian Fleming. So Ian Fleming obviously was driven to drink by some of the things he did in the war. Ends up as creator of this incredibly successful spy novel series. Roald Dahl, who was a kind of liaison officer, wasn't he? So he was sort of he got a stint in Washington doing sort of Anglo-American propaganda. He gets rewarded with this. He's a good writer, great stories.
You've got Fleming wrong there. I think he was basically doing penance, writing these novels. He wasn't naturally going to be a novelist, but he realized the only way to get all this stuff out of his system was to do something for the public. And, you know, it was a sort of penance. And Wheatley is a very important figure in helping him get over that alcoholism and realize that it was a psychological thing. And, you know, it's a bit like today's obesity crisis, right? They keep going on about drugs will deal with it. No, this is because humanity is faced with a potential third world war, a nuclear war. We are badly governed. We've got a competence crisis where the most idiotic, useless accelerationist system pumps these idiots into positions of power who don't know what they're doing or do know what they're doing, and they're doing it wrong deliberately. And this, of course, causes a psychological, it's angst, it's fear in our lives. And so we eat as a comfort, you know, because things are not right. We know things are not right. This is working on a kind of subconscious level. That's what I think, you know.
Yeah, but I'm quite interested in how they do it, who they are, and how they get away with it. So there's something I wanted to mention to you, which crops up in your book. You talk about how Leo Cooper, who was the husband of Jilly Cooper, the author of Horsey Potboilers with lots of sex in them, Leo Cooper ran a military book publishing, a small publishing imprint called Pen and Sword. And I used to read a lot of his books, and I would probably have met Leo Cooper at literary parties. He was a lovely chap. But you mention that, was it Brian Horrocks, who before he died, entrusted to Leo Cooper a letter in which he detailed the, was it Brian Horrocks?
Yes, that's right. He was in Somerset, by the way.
A kind of deathbed confession,
It wasn't quite deathbed. It was quite a long time before he died, but he said he gave it to Leo and said, "Well, after I'm dead, please open this and read it. It's about Arnhem." And so, because he realised that there was the proper story hadn't really been told, and a lot of people were pointing the finger of blame at him. But this then apparently disappeared, this letter. And I spoke to Jilly about this, actually, and she said, well, actually, Leo was really disorganised. And so he might...
Leo was really what?
Disorganised. So he might have just lost it. So he put it in a pile of paper.
Well, he might have done, and that's plausible. I can see that. I mean, as a disorganized person myself, I could easily see how you could lose a letter like that. And yet, I'm thinking this would have been absolute dynamite. This would have been, especially if you're a publisher of military histories, you have got, I mean, like the Holy Grail. You've got the commander of 30 Corps giving you a deathbed confession of the real reason. I mean, everyone's, military historians, everyone is asking, why did the 30 Corps stop their advance? Here's the commander giving you the real reason. What? You're just going to, oh, I can't remember where I had
quite a good relationship with Tim Sanders, who wrote the Nijmegen book, and he explained a lot of this to me. He said the background is there is, he was the expert on the Nijmegen part of that battle. But he wouldn't. I said to him, when did you last go to a reunion? Oh, he said, I haven't been to a reunion for over a decade now. He said, it's all so political. You can't, if you start to say the wrong thing, that you get shut down, you get people come stand in front of you, turn their back on you. It was horrible, you know, because they didn't really want to know what had happened. They didn't want to know. None of the people organizing these reunions wanted to know about the role of Browning. He was the hero, you know, who tried so hard, but everyone else let him down. But that wasn't the case. And he knew that. So maybe that's why Leo was a little bit nervous about opening this letter, because he knew that there'd be a political firestorm hitting him before he could even get it published, possibly. And of course, his outfit has been taken over now. In fact, I was discussing with them, I think they're in Barnsley, aren't they, writing this book. And I went up there, had a chat to the publisher. I can't remember what his name is, Charles, I think, something. Had a good old chat with him for about 25 minutes, got in the car, carried on my little excursion up to that part of the country. I got a letter back a week later saying, oh, I've changed my mind. Don't want to do this now.
Well, look, you've given a favorable gloss on the story about Leo Cooper and the Horrocks letter. Is it not equally plausible that this is just a classic case of the establishment closing ranks? I mean, Jilly Cooper was a friend of the current Queen's. So we're not talking ordinary working class folk here who know nothing about the establishment. We are talking people who are very close to the establishment. It would have taken, as you say, tremendous courage on Cooper's part. It's much easier for him to say, well, I've got this rather embarrassing letter and I'm not sure what to do with it.
MI5 has come and filched
it, old boy.
Surely MI5 may have come and filched it anyway.
They may have done, but how would they know about it?
Well, because they're quite interested in military publishers. They keep an eye on military publishers. They would certainly be.
Yeah, but come on. Leo Cooper isn't going to be going, oh, I'm just going to give a press release explaining that I've got this I've been given this letter by Brian Horrocks to be published after his death. No, he'd have kept it quiet, but he may have told somebody.
Well, listen, I don't think...
I mean, even if it was only Jilly.
Maybe they were keeping a very close eye on Brian. I don't know. But, you know, that may be the case. I mean, I think, you know, in our own family, we've got Bletchley Park in our family. And I can always remember down in Painswick, there was a guy called Neil Webster, who there's been a book out called, I think it's called Bletchley Park, The Secret Room, or Cribs for Victory, all about him. Very interesting character. And they were just about to post a manuscript of some of his memoirs down in Painswick in the post box. And it was actually nothing to do with the manuscript. It was a completely separate issue. But as he's about to post this rather large letter, someone stepped out from behind the posting something, Webster. So they were keeping a very close eye on people who knew stuff during the war, particularly the Ultra, because he knew a lot about how that had all operated, you know, the secret code breaking. I mean, one thing I really ought to mention, if you want to get a good background of World War II, is William Stevenson's book, A Man Called Intrepid. I think it's one of the best looks at, you know, sort of standing back from World War II, what was really going on, how we had an Enigma machine before the war had even started. We'd managed to get a hold of one. And so we were decrypting their stuff right from the start. And that in the Rockefeller Center in New York, there was a whole, before the Americans entered the war, there was a whole operation going on which was a joint British-American intelligence operation against the Nazis. So there's lots in there where you're realizing that there are things going on behind the scenes, excuse me, during the Second World War and before the Second World War. And then, of course, there's also the links to the First World War. I mean, if you really want to take a step back from all of this, you've got these discussions between the Balmoral and Friedrichshof, the German royal family and the British German royal family. Then you've got the First World War, which is the Cousins' War. This war breaks out between in the family, and millions of people die at the Somme. We've just had the anniversary of that, you know, the commemoration of the Somme, which Allenby then clears the Ottoman Empire out of Palestine. And in the Second World War, we have the creation of the State of Israel, setting up all the problems that we've now got today with this conflict between the Islamic world and these Zionists. You know, I would say they're very little, if any, relationship to Judaism at all.
I'm not cutting you short.
It's looked at, if you want to zoom in sort of halfway between that and World War II, A Man Called Intrepid is a really excellent look at some of the backstory of the Second World War.
Okay. I'm not cutting you short because you're saying stuff that I'm not familiar with or not comfortable dealing with, but I think we should have another conversation, Tony, because you're obviously a mine of information, and I've really enjoyed chatting to you. Tell me, where can we get the traitors of Armin?
There's all the individuals involved, and there's also a whole load of the good guys in here too. You know, there are some brilliant people. Frost, one of them. You know, so the
actual chaps on the ground were extraordinary men. I met a few of them and they were
absolutely hopeless, you know. So there was a mixture of mistakes as well made, you know, but it was quite clear they should never have been sent in there. It's quite clear the Germans knew they were coming. There were lies put out about putting the plans in a glider. Do you remember that? They said that, the Germans found plans in a crash. Of course they don't send the plans with the gliders. What are you talking about?
That was a cover for Lindemann, I think, as you suggested. Yeah. Tony, where can we find you? I mean, not I don't mean where you live, but
I live in St. Paul's in Bristol. I'm actually up in Gloucestershire at the moment, but the podcast, the weekly show, will be looking at the East Bristol livable neighbourhood nightmare for the people that live there. These roadblocks going up and everything, and the fact that they've done it in one of the poorest areas of the city, not the wealthy areas where the locals have got money to campaign against it, and that the bus service is appalling. So we do a bit of Bristol, Britain, and around the world. So we'll be also looking at the situation in Bahrain, you know, we've just had the bombing of Bahrain. So I just carry on doing national, and because one of the things that really annoys me, James, is the way we don't have, apart from in Scotland and a little bit in Wales, we don't have any international or national news coverage from anywhere but London. It's all centred in London. It's all based in London. Why can't cities like Manchester, Bristol, we used to have The Guardian, Bristol, other big cities, every city, why can't Norwich have its own national and international take on events? We've got communities from all over the world in Bristol, particularly places like Somalia. We've got Chinese. So we try and make sure that we get their point of view, a genuine Bristol point of view. And that's every Friday live from 5 till about 7:30. And you can find that. If you want to go straight to the stream, it's talkradio.org.uk. But the show page, which has got all the links to all the various articles, is thisweek.org.uk. And you'll find me at the beginning of the show saying, don't believe a word we say, which is rather the opposite to BBC Verify, because I like people to just think, well, you know, I'm not making any great claims for what we do, but I think the truth will speak for itself.
Thank you, Tony. It's been great talking to you. We'll do it again. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, James. Right.
There is now a new, better way of supporting me. If you want to, you can now subscribe direct at jamesdellingpole.co.uk. It's now got new features where you can subscribe directly to me. You get access to all my old archive material. You get my podcasts as they come out. And you can comment on the podcasts and you can communicate with me probably more directly than you can elsewhere. I think it's probably the best way forward. Also, it obviates the risk of my being suddenly randomly closed down by some of these other websites. I mean, they're not our friends. So if you want to support me direct, go to jamesdellingpole.co.uk and sign up there. Without your support, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. So thank you.
Support ridiculously honest, no holds barred, independent truth seeking at jamesdellingpole.co.uk. The Delling Pod is produced by Wolfish Limited. Guests are very kindly booked by the lovely Venetia. The show is edited by Andrew Warwick, with animation by Warwick A.